Revolutionary Strategy and Tactics in the Trade Unions, Part 1. This is a talk by Mike Byrne, delivered in Brisbane on April 28, 2006. In this talk, Mike Byrne discusses the way socialists analyse the trade union movement under capitalism and the role of the labour aristocracy. He also reviews some of the key parameters which guide a revolutionary orientation to the trade unions. Mike Byrne is a CPSU job delegate, a member of the Socialist Alliance, and the Democratic Socialist Perspective.
Hi guys, in writing this talk, this is going to be in two parts. Firstly, I was going to talk about the labour aristocracy and the union bureaucracy and so on, and look at some of the ways of organising within the trade union movement. And in going through a lot of this, it's so relevant and it's so clear to see what's happening today in the trade union movement. You know, particularly with the Howard's work choice laws and the campaign, or the lack of campaign, being put up by the trade union leadership, the ACTU and the ALP. And I'm sure as we're going through some of this, everyone will be able to insert their sort of least favourite union official or leader. You know, there's many of them to choose from. But I think a good starting point was from the Communist Manifesto, which goes on to say, with the development of industry, the proletariat not only increases in number, it becomes concentrated in great masses. Its strength grows, and it fills that strength more. The various interests and conditions of life within the ranks of the proletariat are more and more equalised in proportion as machinery obliterates all distinction of labour and nearly everywhere reduces wages to the same level. The growing competition amongst the bourgeoisie and the resulting commercial crises make the wages of the worker even more fluctuating. The unceasing improvement of machinery, ever more rapidly developing, makes their livelihood more and more precarious. The collisions between individual workers and individual bourgeois takes more and more of the character of the collision between two classes. Thereupon, the workers begin to form combinations, or unions as they're called now, against the bourgeoisie. They club together in order to keep up the rate of wages. They found permanent associations in order to make provision beforehand for these occasional revolts. Here and there, the contest breaks out into riots. Now and then, the workers are victorious, but only for a time. The real fruits of their battles lie not in the immediate result, but in the ever-expanding union of workers. I think looking at this written over 150 years ago, it's very clear that talking about the equalisation of wages and so on, you know, more technology, lowering wages, it's very sort of clear this is still in process. But this initial spontaneous drive to class unity is driven by capitalism itself. It was, and it still is, the inescapable drive of the capitalists to increase their profits at the expense of workers, just as inescapably calls forth organised resistance by workers. And it's their tendency to embrace the entire workforce that the unions remain primarily defensive organisations, their perspectives necessarily being limited by the stage of consciousness reached by the working class as a whole. It's their tendency. History shows that unions on their own cannot go beyond the defence of immediate needs of the working class, and that the consistent struggle for socialist revolution is necessary to meet the interests of the working class. The fundamental tendency of capitalism, particularly within imperialist countries, creates subsidiary divisions within the working class that counteract this tendency towards class unity. And without revolutionary leadership, these secondary divisions prevent or disrupt full working class unity. Now, constant divisions are fostered by the bourgeoisie along racial lines, along national, sexual and age divisions, whilst particular sections of the proletariat can be singled out along craft lines for relatively favoured treatment. And as different circumstances of the working class are compelled to struggle at different times and in different circumstances, the level of trade union organising varies widely, as workers in the same trade are the most equalising interests and conditions, and the original impulse towards unionism often took the form of workers in certain industries or crafts joining together. And this in itself has, not always, but generally becomes an obstacle to further development of unity within the class. And with the development of imperialism, the ruling class were able to convert some of these accidental differences in the union movement between different sections into more long-lasting divisions by using the super profits obtained from the colonies. And the section of the working class, and generally one that had won its relative conditions through previous struggle, was converted into a support base for the continuing function of capital. This aristocracy of labour was fostered as a means of dividing and misleading the proletariat, the working class as a whole. I mean, this can be seen sort of very much today. The special privileges through the higher standard of living compared to the rest of the working class gave the labour aristocracy a consciousness of group interests opposed to the interests of the broader class as a whole. And one of the chief causes hampering the revolutionary working class movement in developed capitalist countries is the fact that because of the colonial possessions and the super profits gained by finance capital, the capitalists in these countries were able to create a relatively larger and more stable aristocracy, although still a very small minority of the working class. But this minority, over the years, has enjoyed better terms of employment. It's often imbued with a narrow-minded sort of craft spirit within their union and groupings, and imbued with petty bourgeois and imperialist prejudices, which, of course, the ruling class play on. And this was the real pillar of the Second International of the Reformists and the Centrists. This would have been at the beginning of the last century. And at this time, it might even have been called the mainstay of the bourgeoisie, as Lenin said. And this conservative outlook is constantly reinforced by capitalist ideology to persuade both the aristocracy and the proletariat as a whole that this is a natural order of things. It's a just reward for submission to the interests of capital, and it promotes class collaborationist practices as a model for the entire working class to follow. Now, the labour aristocracy forms a primary social base for most of the entrenched bureaucracies that control the union movement in Australia. And these bureaucracies were reinforced during the long capitalist boom following the Second World War and the exploitation of the colonies and semi-colonies. And these conditions allowed the bourgeoisie to grant the proletariat a steadily rising standard of living, thus creating a climate for class collaborationist attitudes. And this period generally allowed conservative leaderships of the union movement to increase and consolidate their hold on our trade unions through appearing to be able to deliver an increasing level of gains, conditions, salary, etc., just through polite bargaining and arbitration with the bosses. So during this period, any militant trade unionists were generally sort of sidelined as, oh no, you're going a little bit too far, we can get these demands if we just sit back and wait a little and negotiate politely. And this, coupled with the climate of the Cold War at the time as well, it was very easy to isolate militant unionists, accusing them of being communist, go back to Russia or China or whatever. And the capitalist state helped create this hardened labour bureaucracy involving the most privileged and conservative workers by distributing the biggest economic and political favours to those who distinguished themselves in civility to the working class, the ruling class, the most. A similar phenomenon in before 1917, Lenin wrote, the important thing is that, economically, the desertion of a stratum of the labour aristocracy to the bourgeoisie has matured and become an accomplished fact. And this economic fact, this shift in class relations, will find political form in one shape or another without any particular difficulty. And this political form is generally found at the time of this. It was through the social democratic parties involved in the Second International, and obviously more clearly today it's involved in the Australian Labour Party and the Social Democratic parties in Europe. But petty bourgeois influence also serves to encourage class collaborationist attitudes and thus provide support for the union bureaucracy. Small business people forced into the proletariat bring with them prejudices and anti-working class and anti-union prejudices and other factors as well, such as subcontractors who provide their own tools and various other layers sort of form this sort of petty bourgeois layer of ideas within the working class who aren't necessarily involved or union conscious. And even after the elimination of the economic conditions that led to the conservatism in the ranks of the union, which have happened really acutely over the last couple of decades through the price and incomes accord and so forth, and the erosion of our conditions in more recent times under the Howard government. Even once these conditions that allowed the bureaucracy to establish themselves in the first place, they still generally refused to lead any fight at all against the capitalists, and basically always attempt to convince the ranks that it's pointless to fight the employers head on. And often they'll carry out acts of betrayal or sabotage when workers are actually calling for action or industrial action or so on, rather their modus operandi has always been to rely on the bosses called for the arbitration commissions and so on. And in confrontations between workers and the boss, generally the bureaucracy see themselves as a mediator rather than the representative of the workers. And they do remain a fundamental obstacle to unions carrying out consistent class struggle, even winning day-to-day immediate demands. And the fight for immediate needs. As we said, the unions arose originally as instruments for defending the immediate economic interests of the working class, and it's on this basis that they attract new workers, especially during times of increasing class conflict. And the struggle to transform the unions into revolutionary instruments therefore incorporates the fight for the immediate needs of the working class. The defence of our immediate needs is a continuous task, not one that arises only in times of strikes and industrial disputes. This requires our comrades carefully analyse what the most pressing needs and objective needs are and develop demands and proposals that say and put forward most effectively these needs. Then on the job and through other instruments such as Green Left Weekly, we clearly need to explain how and why our proposals meet this need in the most effective way to fight for these demands. And this approach should never include any degree of ultimatism. We're not seeking to issue orders, nor do we refuse to support any demand from the union rank and file that helps solve any problems confronting us or the working class. So it's a quotation from Trotsky. He said, every organisation, every party, every faction which permits itself an automatic position in relation to the trade union, i.e. in essence turns its back upon the working class merely because of a displeasure with its organisation, every such organisation are destined to perish, and it must be said it deserves to perish. So in the campaign against work choices, revolutionaries will spring to the fore the class struggle methods that are not only most likely to defeat this legislation but also to advance the class consciousness and the confidence of the union membership. At this moment, we're correctly arguing for a mass action strategy involving the entire union movement with community support and calling for open and democratic organising of this strategy, with a full involvement from union membership through mass meetings, which will hold the union leadership accountable for its actions and to carry out the democratically decided wishes of the membership. Now, the transformation of our unions into instruments of revolutionary struggle will be a process where growing numbers of workers become conscious of both class struggle and the methods necessary to provide victory in the struggle. This section of workers makes up the class struggle left wing needed to mobilise increasing sections of workers to break the hold of the bureaucracy on our unions. And the class struggle left wing will need to repeatedly take up the following major themes: a trade union democracy, class independence and working class unity or solidarity. And through the struggle against the bureaucracy, though this is not an end in itself, it is part of building a more effective fight against the ruling class. So democracy, class independence and unity enter into the task of transforming the unions and removing the obstacles that prevent a consistent fight for our objectives. And they unify the fight against the bureaucracy with the fight against capitalists, whereby they simultaneously attack the programme and methods of the bureaucrats and strengthen the unions as militant organisations in class struggle. Now just going on a few things from there, some more specific examples of the role that trade union bureaucracy have played and struggles to actually fight them. The major barrier holding back, as we've heard, trade unions from fulfilling their role is the bureaucracy. And in some unions in Australia, it's usually successful in preventing its members from taking industrial action to defend their rights. The bureaucracy that does lead the struggle, but only inconsistently and without the democratic involvement of the rank and file, includes unions which are normally considered left-wing in ALP terms. And some of these unions, the officials refuse to allow delegates meetings, which we've often seen, even when there's threats of job losses and so on. And many unions are structured in the way that members never meet other members from outside their workplace, and therefore it's extremely difficult for rank-and-file members to pressure unwilling officials and so on to lead campaigns. Though not all union officials are part of the bureaucracy, the vast majority of union officials in Australia are. New union officials who have a genuine desire to build militant unions which are based on the democratic participation, rank and file experience, enormous pressures to succumb to the dominant outlook of the bureaucracy. However, during big struggles, some junior officials who are part of the bureaucracy can shift to supporting a militant class struggle approach. I guess that's what we're looking at in the current context, where we've got the trade union bureaucracy in the ACTU and the various trades and labour councils around the country playing a very negative role in the campaign against work choices, where essentially they're trying to channel all of the efforts of the union movement into marginal seats campaigns and community campaigns, essentially based around getting the ALP re-elected at the next election. I mean, a slogan I've heard about three or four times, which I'm getting a little bit fed up with hearing from the state secretary of my union, the CPSU, is that only the government can make the laws, therefore only the government can change them. So we need to put all our efforts into voting the Howard government out and hoping that the next lot in, you know, somehow miraculously come to our rescue and overturn these laws. And this is the complete limit of the thinking of some of the trade unions officials in Australia at the moment, particularly some of the more sort of moderate white-collar unions, although certainly around the country there are calls for action on June 28, which is being called as part of a week of action in the national community protest. We've seen unions already in Victoria, WA, and even the ETU in Queensland calling for stop works and so on. The question is actually, and the point of this is to keeping pressure on not only building up solidarity and contacts and networking within the union ranks, but also keeping pressure on the bureaucracy through actually building our rank and file work. I think Sue in the next part is going to talk more about the revolutionary approach to trade union organising and examples of where workers have actually taken control, even in unions that have been like traditionally dominated or by the labour aristocracy and so on. I'll leave it there, but actually I'll just say in the links there's some really good articles. There's a series of about three or four articles by Jonathan Strauss on the role of the trade union aristocracy, and I really recommend people reading that, and also from our pamphlet Revolutionary Strategies and Tactics in Trade Unions.